The next case of the morning is number 06-2114. Hertinasai against Gonzalez. Armbrecht. Ms. Wong here. Is counsel for the next case, Ms. Christensen and Ms. McKee, are they here?
Yes.
Well, we'll take that case first, and if you would be so kind as to try to find Ms. Wong, please. So the case we're going to hear next is number 053557, the United States against Strong. Ms. Christensen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Mr. Strong in this matter. When one reads the trial transcript, either one of the trial transcripts, but specifically the second one, it's impossible to tell what the charges are. There was so much evidence presented that was not related to either one of the remaining charges at the second trial that it ceased to be about those charges and became about Mr. Strong being a bad person who was a criminal who needed to go to jail. The government argues that the evidence of the uncharged conduct and then, of course, acquitted conduct was inextricably intertwined with the legitimate evidence of the two remaining charges.
As I understand the government's argument, it's, you know, there are these two, I love these videos, scene one, scene two, but there are these, I know, I mean, it is the way to describe it, but there are these videos that explain how the materials charged in the two counts that were still in the case came to be found, and whether you call it inextricably intertwined or whether you call it 404B, that there were two important facts that all of this brought out. One, whether he in fact possessed, I mean the actual possession element of the case, and two, motivation, you know, why would he of all people want to have this gun, this ammunition? Of course, he winds up only being ammunition, so one might think the jury was trying to be careful. I don't doubt that, you know, juries are probably not terribly impressed by lots of drugs around, but why are they not pertinent to that, and why did the judge's limiting instructions not do the job to keep the jury focused on what was important?
I think as to the drugs specifically, and I can address then the other categories as well, but the drugs specifically, I will concede there is some relevance between and connection between drug evidence and drug dealing and gun possession, and that's clearly established in precedent. What's also established is there has to be a limit to the amount of extraneous evidence that's put in. And because even if it's inextricably intertwined or 404B, you still have to go through the Rule 403 balancing test, whether the probative value is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
And you know, it's got to be a rare case where we have found a 403 abuse of discretion by the time you get through either route to 403. Mm-hmm. It's so much a district court decision to decide, is this too much? And again, similarly to one of the earlier cases this morning, I'm not sure what rule of law we would invoke to say, you know, the Judge Tinder in this case, you know, could have admitted, you know, half of the video, or, you know, I don't know where you think he should have drawn the line, because you seem to concede that some of it could have come
in. I do concede that some of it could have come in.
But what comes in and what stays out if we're running this properly?
I think that when we're talking about the videotapes are clearly, I don't know if the court has seen them, they're in the record, or they're supposed to be, but they're clearly cut off at the end of each scene. It's not a flowing tape. And I think one easy way to limit that is to take out the scenes that really had nothing to do with either one of the counts. And I've gone through those scenes in the brief on pages 12 and 13 of my brief. There's several scenes during the first search that are various types of drugs, various types of prescription medication that was never at issue here. And then as far as tape, the first tape, a 9mm handgun. That could have easily been cut out. I think the danger here, and this may be one of those rare cases, is that there are two factors. One is, when I read the transcript, and I was not trial counsel, but when I read the transcripts, it was difficult for me to sort out what was what and what charge went with what charge and what exactly is here. In the end, the 9mm ammunition that was charged in what became count two was in the living room, but there was 9mm ammunition in other parts of the house, but that was no longer charged.
Isn't it interesting, though, that the jury did acquit on the firearm charge in count one, and the ammunition that they convict on is the one that I guess has little pieces of paper with his, I don't know whether they were the bills or something that identifies him right next to him.
Yes, the 9mm ammunition, what I can tell from the record, it is what was in the living room with identifying documents. And that was my second point, is that in a lot of these cases that are affirmed, it's based on the overwhelming evidence harmless error analysis. And in this case, we can't get there. I think that the fact that the jury only convicted him of the ammunition, acquitted him of the gun count, shows that there was not overwhelming evidence in this case.
And well, and of course, they acquitted him on all the other counts in the first trial, except these last two. Yeah, the first jury.
The other jury. If you look at it, he was charged with six counts and only convicted of one. And nobody knows what the jury was thinking. We can't. But it's very possible that they split the difference because of the overwhelming amount of evidence that was not about the charges, but it was about Mr. Strong's propensity to commit criminal acts, to have all this ammunition, to have three guns, one of which was never charged, to have all of these drugs, both, you know, illicit illegal drugs and prescription drugs. I think that the overwhelming amount of evidence not related to either one of the charges is what makes this, pushes this over that threshold, that 403 threshold.
How much was it stressed at the second trial that the house was that of his stepfather? He pretty much conceded that he lived there some of the time, didn't he?
He definitely conceded he stayed there. With some regularity. His stepfather was very elderly, as you can actually see on the videotapes when he's introduced. But there's also evidence that there were other people living there during the time, his brother, Johnny Strong, who testified, and then I believe another brother and that brother's wife, I think I've got that straight, also lived there, and it was brought out that they were the ones who brought in the rifle, the SKS rifle, that was in the southwest bedroom. I think that played to the jury as well, saying there's an awful lot of stuff here. Who belongs to who? We don't know. Let's just split the difference. I think that does show that the jury was confused. As a layperson, you might not know how to differentiate between all the different kinds of ammunition in this case. And you look at it and you think, it's a lot of bullets. And you say, he's got to be doing something wrong. But that's not how we strive to convict people of crimes. He was charged with specific crimes, and I believe the district court needed to tailor the evidence in some fashion, not cutting out everything because some of it is admissible. The drug evidence, some of it would be admissible. My point, to make it clear, is the extraneous bullets and guns, I think, should not have been admissible under any circumstance. They just were cumulative and showing just extra burden on top of the gun he actually
was there an
was
objection at the trial on 403 grounds?
I'm sorry?
Was there an objection raised at trial on 403 grounds?
I believe there was, Your Honor. There were several objections, and the district court actually allowed defense counsel to have a standing objection to the evidence.
On 403 as opposed to 404?
I don't remember specifically if they said the rule 403. But I know that defense counsel argued that it was prejudicial to Mr. Strong and that he argued it wasn't relevant. He argued that it wasn't 404B. I think they covered the objections. I don't remember specifically if Rule 403 was mentioned, although the district court in its ruling seemed to consider Rule 404B as an alternative and also Rule 403.
Or the court ruled that this was admissible on inextricably intertwined.
That was
basis.
The ultimate ruling, and then an alternative ruling of 404B, which is why I addressed both of them in the brief to cover, of course, all my bases. I was made aware of the just quick by the clerk's office that the court may not have gotten the trial exhibits as part of the record, and I will ensure that those are part of the record as soon as I return to Peoria, because they're essential to our case, obviously, particularly the videotape. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Ms. McKee.
It is the government's position here that this is a question about the discretion of the district court, whether it was properly exercised. And in this case, we believe that it was. Judge Tinder analyzed all of the evidence. He heard the arguments. He presided at both trials. And for the second trial, he made the decision that the evidence of other ammunition, other firearms, and the drugs in the house were not only inextricably intertwined, his first ruling, but also that they would have been admissible under Rule 404B.
And what's so inextricable about some of this, though? I mean, true, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and that's certainly something that we take very seriously, but it doesn't mean the discretion is never abused. And when you have, you know, a tail wagging the dog kind of problem, you have to look pretty carefully to see if there was just so much about other guns, other this, other that, that the jury couldn't possibly have followed the dots.
Well, I think, first of all, you're right, they did follow the dots. They got the limiting instructions numerous times throughout the trial, and as this court's noted, they did not convict on the firearm in which Mr. Strong's fingerprint was actually found. So I don't think this jury got confused. I think it was able to sort through and make a decision. It picked the ammunition that was lying on the table with his identifying documents associated with it, even though Mr. Strong, who testified, said, "I never saw that ammunition." So I think the jury made credibility decisions about that, too. And
the documents didn't have to do, they weren't like a receipt for the ammunition. I thought they were like utility bills or something.
I meant they identified Mr. Strong, not
right.
That they identified the ammunition, no.
Well, and they didn't necessarily link. You know, it's like if I put, you know, my ComEd bill next to a box of something, maybe the box belongs to me, maybe it doesn't.
Correct. Mr. Strong also was there. They heard evidence, was there both times. First time told the officers that was his address. The second time denied that. I think what was inextricably intertwined is you've got this house full of guns and drugs and ammunition, and an average juror's house probably isn't full of those things and is wondering how does all this
come. I don't know about the guns in central Illinois. I think there are a lot of hunters.
Well, that's possible. Perhaps I speak for my own house. It is possible that some jurors did have that. But here I think the court felt it was fair and appropriate for them to be told why all these things were there, why the police were there twice in the space of the 15-month period to serve those search warrants, and to give the government and the jurors a clear chance to present a picture of what actually went on here. Judge Tinder exercised his discretion to do that. Even if he had not done that, there was a strong case. Even if you'd taken out all those other things, you still would have had Mr. Strong in that house with the identifying documents, with the ammunition, with the SKS, with the fingerprint.
And the government arguing constructive possession?
Yes, in the sense that we never saw Mr. Strong actually handle those items, Your Honor, yes. We saw his fingerprint on the SKS, which presumes he must have handled it, which he explained by saying, yes, I touched it once when my brother, Johnny, was showing me the firearm. So I think what we come back to, and from the government's point of view, is that this was an appropriate exercise of district court's discretion, and we would ask this court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Ms. McKee. There's 1 minute left for Ms. Christensen.
Your Honors, I'd like to touch on the very beginning about the abuse of discretion standard. If there can never be some way to overcome the standard, then why is there an abuse of discretion standard? It has to mean something. And in this case, it could have been so easily tailored to the two remaining counts by cutting out portions of the video that were already in segments. The first video was only 5 minutes and some change long, and I think common sense says that the search lasted for much longer than 5 minutes and 12 seconds. The second tape was 8 minutes long. So they had already been significantly edited, and they could have been edited to take out parts that had nothing to do with either one of the charges. And as for the ammunition in the living room is actually in a different scene of the videotape than the document in the living room containing Mr. Strong's name. The living room is not large, but they are actually in two different scenes on the videotape. Conceitedly, that could be relevant, and is relevant. I can see that in my brief. But those two points could have been shown without the extraneous information. Unless the court has further questions, I'd respectfully request the court to reverse and remand for new trial.
Apparently not. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.